In one of the most popular episodes of Money on the Left, we spoke with Harvard legal historian Christine Dizon about the historical erasure of money's political and legal constitution in 17th century England and beyond. In our most recent episode, however, we chatted with our friend Andres Bernal about the rise of a modern money movement which aims to challenge these forces of repression in order to put public money to work for public purposes. Inspired by both modern monetary theory and Dizon's complementary constitutional theory of money, today's movement is made up of scholars, activists, journalists, nonprofits, and policymakers, all focused on recovering and mobilizing money's unrealized powers in service of social and ecological justice.
In many ways, it makes sense to trace the origins of what we're calling the modern money movement to the global financial crisis of the last decade. But there is, of course, a much longer history at play here. For more about the history of money politics, that is, political organizing and activism around the question of money's democratic potentials, we are glad to be joined this episode by Jakob Feinig, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University. We speak with Feinig about his research on the history of money politics in the United States, from the colonial, pre-revolutionary period to Occupy Wall Street. Here's our conversation.
Jakob Feinig, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we were wondering if you could start with talking a little bit about your personal background and scholarly background and how you came to the question of money politics.
So I grew up in Austria, and I was doing a degree that was very deeply connected to political economy. And when I started learning about, you know, money creation, and I had all those aha moments that I'm sure many listeners also had at some point, when I started learning as part of my studies about money creation and political economy, how it's connected to unemployment, to central banking, etc., to commercial banking, at that time, the euro became, there was the famous changeover to the euro. And I sort of started understanding what that meant for countries like Austria, but also other countries, and especially in the European periphery. And I couldn't believe that everyone around me was completely uncritically celebrating it. And I started looking for ways of understanding the relation between the institutions that create money and the people who use it. And I was struck that I couldn't find a good way of thinking about that as an actual historically existing and changing relation. So really, even though the ECB never really shows up in my writings, what it is driven by that idea of trying to find a way of speaking about that relation.
Later on, you came to America to then explore those interests. Where did you do your PhD?
I did my PhD in Binghamton University in a department that's focused very much on historical sociology that has an important tradition of critical political economy. It's a department of Emmanuel Wallerstein and Giovanni Arrighi. So it's very deeply rooted in historically thinking about economic life and political economy.
Most of our efforts in the present neo-chartalist and constitutional money movement is dedicated to critiquing, imposing theoretical alternatives to the orthodoxy, be it classical, neoclassical, liberal, or neoliberal. But in your work, you're doing something rather unique, which is that you're actually unearthing a repressed genealogy of popular left democratic monetary movements that can provide a really rich and complicated but nevertheless positive resource for the contemporary left. And maybe to ease us into this discussion and to start us off, you can tell us a little bit about how you're framing this intervention. I'm thinking, like, how... You're in sociology, right? And you're in the field of historical sociology. That's correct?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
So where does money sit in your field, and how are you responding to those who have either directly or indirectly taken on the question of money, monetary politics, etc.?
Sure. So there are two major ways of thinking about money historically, or that might resonate with your listeners, or what your listeners already know. One of them is sort of the classical sociological approach, that people relate to money primarily because money dissolves all bonds, it dissolves social relations, all that is solid melts into air. It's very grounded in Marx and Simmel, in that canonized tradition. So these very broad claims about money being an individualizing force and breaking apart communities and traditions, etc. That's one larger broader claim about money. The other one is more recent, and that's the most famous writer is Viviana Salazar, who writes about money more in terms of micro relations, the meanings of money, challenging similar Marx and saying that, well, money is actually more complicated. It doesn't mean that everyone is individualized. It's just a different way of relating to people. But she focuses on very much on the micro level, not on the macro level, on what people do in households with money, how gender relations, etc. So I'm distancing myself from both of those traditions, because I ask how people, by that I mean money users, how do they relate to the actual institutions that issue money? How do they relate not to money as just to their bank accounts, or how do they organize their money in households, but how do they relate as political beings to the institutions that issue money? How does that change over time, and how does it shape possibilities for political actions? So it's really a deep historical thinking about, you know, who are we in relation to those institutions, right? And the goal is really to unearth this, to emphasize that in relation to money, we're much more recent than we think. The way we relate to money is much more recent than we think, and it's therefore much more easily changeable than we think.
Great. So where would the work of Jeffrey Ingham fit into those two camps, and also in relation to your own work, the Jeffrey Ingham, the sociologist who wrote the book The Nature of Money?
So Jeffrey Ingham, he is, it's complicated, but I would say that he is more on the very large institutional, he offers something that's distinct from both Simmel and Marx and Salazar. He offers a very large institutional approach to money, focusing on very large patterns of money issue. He does not look at how money users' knowledge is shaped, how social movements understand monetary institutions, and how the very constitution of money changes over time by involving people in different ways in it.
And maybe to talk about or deepen your understanding of the relationship between canonical sociology and contemporary sociology, what I know of Ingham is that he seems to rely on Weber and his thinking about power, and I know you have a critique of the Weberian approach to money. And do you see that? How do you see that potentially influencing Ingham?
So I think Ingham is more complicated. We can focus maybe more because he also draws on Searle and this notion of collective intentionality. And at the same time, he draws very much on the Weberian notion of legitimacy. So maybe we can just focus on the legitimacy part without really claiming to do justice to the complexity of his thought about Searle. So the idea of legitimacy, that people relate to public institutions through legitimacy, means that they're somehow external. They relate to what they think is legitimate. They don't relate as thinking beings who can understand the relation and what's at stake, right? They have a superficial, they relate to institutions, to public institutions, to institutions of governance. They relate to them on a superficial level by thinking, well, they're legitimate or they're not. Right, but that's from a participatory democratic perspective, that's a a fairly problematic assumption that people simply cannot understand the institutions that govern them. And Weber is very clear that he's very skeptical of deep democracy. He's very skeptical of social democracy, and he openly states that he's in favor of elite rule.
So circling back to your own work, Jakob, you contrast processes of what you call monetary silencing to moral economies that are rooted in shared knowledge about money's institutional shaping. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of these terms and where they come from and what their stakes are for you?
Absolutely. So when I talk about moral economies, I talk about events, processes in which money users relate to the institutions that issue money, about monetary knowledge that informs action, direct action. It can also be electoral action or campaigning. And they mobilize an idea of monetary justice that's not limited to questions of distribution or redistribution, to demands for money, for welfare payments, etc. But it involves a claim about what money is, about money's public purpose, about how monetary institutions should be arranged to conform to their specific ideas about justice. Right. So this idea of moral economy, it comes from the British historian E.P. Thompson, who developed it to counter those summary dismissals of non-elite economic thinking that were and still are common and that still are very present in the historiography about popular involvement in monetary institutions, from Shays' Rebellion to the populists to the neo-populists in the 1930s. So it's about taking seriously non-elite economic thought. That's what moral economists are. Moral economies are, and how those non-elite forms of economic thought inform action. So that's one of the poles of my thinking. As I'm trying to understand who mobilizes these moral economies, how they're developed, and then on the other hand, also how they're silenced. And the term of monetary silencing I derive it from a completely different tradition, from the Brazilian thinker Paulo Freire, who says that silence about important political issues is a relation. It's a relation between those who have a voice and those who don't, those who have been silenced. And for him, such situations of silence are dehumanizing because they embody a denial of people's right to participate in making their own history. So I try to look at processes of monetary silencing, which from that perspective are really also processes of dehumanization, because they disconnect people from the institutions that condition their individual and collective lives. So it's about excluding people from knowledge, from institutions, and it's about turning them into mere money users and to mere consumers or people whose vision and knowledge doesn't go beyond using a credit card, knowing how to deposit a check, or knowing where to get money from a payday lender, right? So it's about denying and silencing anything that comes close to a structural vision.
Maybe promoting a kind of impoverished sense of financial literacy, it sounds like you're talking about.
Absolutely. And I think even the concept of financial literacy can be a form of silencing if it promotes this very individualist way of thinking that's limited to individuals without any structural vision, right? So it's about, don't worry about the larger institutions. They're all taken care of. Just focus on doing those 1, 2, 3 steps and then learn how to survive as an individual, right? So it can also be a way of depoliticizing money and negating moral economies by saying that they're not really necessary, right? Or it's also, there are many forms of silencing, many of which also inform are kind of truncated moral economies, and so you can have moralistic thinking of money, you can have individualist thinking about money, all kinds of ways of relating to monetary institutions that do not enable people to understand them as institutions. And a very big one that's kind of like a moral economy of fools is of course anti-Semitism, which is a way of creating scapegoats and at the same time distracting attention from the actual institutions that are relevant for money users.
So engenders the kind of silencing or suppression engenders kind of a conspiratorial mindset where it's, the anti-Semitism, but also maybe strong thinking about sound money and the need for, maybe not in any kind of like deeply theoretical sense, but our money should be physical and hard and limited and scarce.
Totally. Those are also very truncated moral economies, which is they mobilize a certain sense of justice and injustice, like commodity money fetishism, or even the Bitcoin movement and this the technophilia and this idea that there is a technological fix to all our problems, right? So those are there is a sense of outrage or of injustice and justice, but it doesn't allow people to connect to the institutions that already exist and that structure our lives. And that can be restructured, right? So they're all kind of they're truncated, and they don't allow a true engagement.
And so your forthcoming book then concentrates through this lens on a fairly large swath of American history, from 1637 to 1936. So why focus on America then in particular? And how does America's then evolving relations to money differ from other nations or other international histories of money politics?
So I think there are two conditions that set the British North American colonies and also later the US apart. And the first one is that two things overlap that in other national histories, in other North Atlantic national histories, do not overlap. In the Middle Ages, there was the money issuing practices and governmental monetary practices were more visible because it was more visible that public authorities issue money to tax it back, it's a creation of authorities, and so an MMT or charterist view of money was, I think, much more common. It was much more easily intelligible, but at that time, of course, popular action or non-elite action was limited to crowd action. It was limited to uprisings, etc. There was no legitimacy, not even for significant parts of the population to participate in electoral processes. Right. So in the American colonies, in the North American colonies, what you have is that there were intelligible modes of money issue, and at the same time there was a significant part of the population, propertied white men, in many, especially in the Northeast, many of them could vote and they could participate. So you have this overlap of intelligibility and significant electoral participation of a specific group, right? And that underlies I think that explains a lot of why there is this recurring dynamic of politicization of money in this geography.
So you tell, again, a pretty large, long story about American monetary politics, and a story that I think really needs to be revived because there's so much rich potential in it. But you also, in addition to pointing out the fact that there are limits and problems with this story, you do begin with a rather cautionary tale, we might say, involved with basically monetary production in the service of settler colonial violence. And I wonder if you can sketch that out for our listeners to get us going.
Sure, absolutely. So in November 1637, the Massachusetts government declared wampum legal tender. A few months before that, one of the worst colonial massacres occurred at Mystic, where the English, together with their native allies, killed 400 Pequots within a half hour. So there are different interpretations of that event and of the Pequot War in general, but to give you a little context, at that time wampum was used to buy furs from natives. So the English used one pound to buy first from natives, and then the English exported it back to Britain in payment of debts they had. And they had basically,
For those who are less familiar with the term wampum, can you describe it? What is it physically?
So those are it's a form of those are shell beads that are manufactured by natives, and that they were used in trade and also in payment of some local taxes by the colonists. So it's a very labor intensive process to produce wampum. It needs to be drilled, and it takes a lot of time. So typically wampum is, or in some histories that you might come across, it's seen as this nice currency that connects settlers with natives, and kind of like a symbol of coexistence almost, and mutually beneficial exchange, when in fact it was a way of organizing trade on a very large scale to the benefit of settlers, and that this is how it happened. The English called the Pequots mint masters because it was the main group that produced wampum. They could make wampum scarce and expensive, and they were also potential competitors in the fur trade, because since they produced this currency, they could themselves buy the fur from inland natives. So after the colonial massacre, the Europeans levied a wampum head tax on each surviving Pequot. They imposed all kinds of fines and dues, and they forced them to deliver tribute, basically. So that meant that from now on, they had a free money supply from the group that had formerly controlled controlled the production of that currency. The English made it legal tender, so that it means that they now had a more plentiful money supply, backed by the furs and also by legal tender status. They could pay schoolmasters in it. They could organize local exchanges in it. They paid town taxes in that, and it was all based on that one terroristic event, but also on the ongoing threat of violence in case of non-payment of tribute. So the reason I start the manuscript with that episode is because in much of the book manuscript I talk about moral economies, and I write mostly about white men's moral economies and their understanding of monetary justice and the political practices that are informed by their idea of monetary justice. And it's very tempting, or many histories of money in the US or North America start with the colonial mint. They start with colonial paper money, overlooking that the first legal tender was based on settler colonial violence. So it's an attempt to avoid idealizing American monetary history by talking about the unspeakable brutality of settler colonialism.
So you begin then with, in a way, a story of monetary silencing, as it's been told in the kind of history books and the white man moral economy history of money in the United States. Could you trace out the kind of rest of your project where you track this silencing and politicization over the rest of your time period?
Absolutely. Okay, so I'll focus on the two great waves of politicization. The first one that we started to talk about a little bit are the moral economies of the 18th century, which is where many propertied white men could vote. They had a moral economy that was based around the idea of white man's independence, which meant that a white man was at the thought of himself as the center of a household, but also the center of gravity of the political economy, to which everyone else was subordinated, including the members of the household, women, children, servants, slaves, and of course the people that they subjected to genocide. So they thought of themselves as the center of that political economic universe, and they thought that that position that they claimed and defended was constituted through money, and they had the right to reorganize money in ways that stabilized their position. So that meant if too many of them went bankrupt, lost their land, lost their status as an independence man, as an independent man, if they saw their status as threatened, then it wasn't their individual fault. It was the fault of the current ways of organizing money. So that means that not enough money reached them as independent white men to stabilize their position, right? That meant that and since they knew and they had experience in reorganizing money, and money was visible as a governmental practice, they said, well, we need to reorganize it to make sure that it reaches us and we don't lose our status. Right, and that's the basic assumption of the moral economy in the 18th century, but also going more forward in the 19th century. And there were several episodes in all over the colonies where that led to clashes between different classes, between creditors and debtors, between also increasing tensions between Britain and the colonists. So there's this whole story. A very complex story where class tensions within the colonies overlap with imperial relations. Okay, so the land bank is one of the most important episodes and events in that period. After the British prohibited paper money issue, a few merchants, together with in a class alliance with the property holding class, small property holders, set up what's called a land bank without getting a charter, and they started circulating those notes against the express opposition of the governor, who was a crown appointee, and who wanted to enforce the British priorities. So they started circulating that money. The money did not have legal tender status. It was not backed by commodities. It was backed by land. And it was, of course, not receivable in payment of taxes. Yet it started circulating. How did that happen? The settlers in individual townships decided that they would accept it in payment of taxes, in payment of local taxes, right? So they were so used to what today is MMT, or this idea that taxes drive money, that they said, well, you know, if the governor and the legislature don't take it in payment of taxes, we'll do it. We'll do it ourselves, right? And that was predictably, it was seen as an outrageously rebellious move. Who are they? Who are these towns to declare what's okay to receive in payment of taxes? And then you had all those. The government resorted to all possible means to stop the land bankers. He dismissed judges. He dismissed militia officers. He condemned the paper money. He withdrew tavern licenses. So there was a real uprising where both sides fought with all the means at their disposal, short of violence.
I could jump in. So on both sides, you have the town people who are accepting those land bank notes. They're accepting those, and then the crown is saying, no, you cannot accept those. And both sides seem to recognize what's at stake, and that is the question of sovereignty. Would you say that's right?
Yes, I would. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And at that time, there was already an emerging moral economy that was different from the moral economies that E.P. Thompson writes about, and then specific to North America, where you have an emerging sense that is somehow connected to rights that are not just traditionally theirs as Englishmen, but that are also connected to an emerging idea. Maybe it's that starts probably a little bit later, that they have the right to redress ills, and that money is part of the sphere that is open to that kind of interventions. And they didn't think about themselves as a rebellious. They thought of themselves as embodying the just social order, right? So all those movements that multiplied towards the revolutionary period, and that connect the pre-revolutionary period with the post-revolutionary period with Che's rebellion, etc., they did not think of themselves as rebels. They thought of themselves as regulators. They thought of themselves as embodying just authority as distinct and opposed to a government that has been led astray, right? And the governance of money was part of that. It was part of a just social order that was not limited to obeying laws. There was a sense of a white man's justice that was not limited to. Obeying the government.
So can you walk us through how a counter tendency, a tendency towards silencing, takes over as we move through the revolutionary period, through the Constitutional Convention, and eventually into Jacksonian America?
Sure. So there were always... Even at the very beginning, already starting in the 1720s, there were writers and thinkers who wrote and published pamphlets in attempt to silence and ridicule moral economies and moral economists. And they said, well, they were openly anti-democratic and they were openly elitist, saying, you know, the rabble cannot participate in this. There is a specific class, wealthy merchants who... have decided that gold is always the commodity. We have to follow their lead. If not, chaos will ensue. So there was always this idea that there's a monetary state of nature is just around the corner. If the government allows people to participate in money politics, so there was always this a kind of a fear of the crowd and a fear of. Of non-elite monetary thinking. One of the most famous pamphleteers is William Douglas, a Boston physician, who also, not surprisingly, as Jeffrey Sklansky has shown in his book, he also opposed this idea that the ideal society is centered around independent white men or around a large number of independent white men. He opposed moral economists of money based on the idea that money cannot and should not be democratic, but also the goal moral economists had, which was creating a society of independent white men, was also not something he agreed with. He wanted a few large landowners, right? So you already have those silencing projects from the very beginning. There was never a moral economy without silencing projects at the same time.
So what happens with the Constitution and after that seems to really change the tenor of your story?
Yeah, it does. It does because, and this I'm building on drawing on the great work by Thierry Bouton and others in a book called Taming Democracy that I highly recommend, is that there was this very clear elite project that Bouton documents about reorganizing money in a way that makes it less democratic by first of all prohibiting the state legislatures from emitting bills of credit, Section 10, Article 1 of the Constitution, and then the second part by placing it in the hands of Congress, which was deliberately constructed as an institution that's less open to non-elite pressure, right? So, and then after that, after you have that reorganization, after a few years, we start seeing a truncated moral economy. We start seeing the moral economy of Jacksonianism, where paper money is now unpopular because the banks issue it. Banks are very different from the colonial legislatures. Even though it's both paper money, banks issue paper money, supposedly backed by commodities. So did the legislatures also issued paper money, not backed by commodities, but the notes that people hold in their hands are made of the same material thing. They're identical. But whereas previously it was paper money was a symbol of popular sovereignty, of popular democracy, of participation, now paper money becomes a symbol of corporate prerogative. Right? So it becomes very easy to deride paper money, to attack it, and to think that paper money is always bad, it's always arbitrary, it's always anti-democratic, and people even start lumping together colonial practices with the corporate banks of the antebellum era, right? And then from there, once you have completely changed the functioning and the meaning of paper money, from there, it's just one step to saying, well, because paper money is always arbitrary, it's always anti-democratic, because there is something inherently bad about paper money, therefore we need to go back to an invented tradition, which is commodity money. And that's when you have this idea that was previously completely unthinkable, and it's I think one of the most striking examples of an invented tradition, that commodity money is the popular and the non-elite and the insurgent way of organizing money.
And so a crucial part of the way you work through this history in your manuscript is you make an argument about periodization. In particular, you draw a line at the New Deal as a specific moment in which the politicization of money becomes silenced. And I was wondering if we could work through this history with that in mind and think about the ways in which the 19th century and early 20th century more democratically inclined monetary populists or during the Civil War greenbacks really demonstrate a flourishing in the politicization of money and the ways in which perhaps moral economies are being created by actors throughout this American history.
Of course, and to maybe briefly remind readers that as an unintended consequence of Civil War finance, there was a departure from the gold standard, and the government, the U.S. government, issued paper money that was not convertible into anything else and was receivable in payment of almost all taxes, and that they issued that, and as an unintended consequence of that, different groups picked up on that, because there was this ideology of independence, and this idea of independent white man was that connects the colonial era with the post-war era, but that connects it, but the way that's connected to money changes all the time, right? So one part of the ideology changes, but the other one does not. Enabled by that unintended politicization, you have all kinds of movements. In quite different from the colonial era, now you have significant alliances between poor whites and blacks around greenback parties after the end of Reconstruction. There were also very significant alliances between populists, black and white, that threatened redeemers, that threatened Southern democracy, including in Virginia, where there was a biracial alliance called the Readjusters that issued state bonds that circulated as pay tokens to hire teachers, build schools, etc. So you have a really significant an about turn in terms of how non-elite groups relate to money, and for the first time there are significant biracial alliances. So this wave of moral economy and this wave of moral economy of money, it's typically people or historians think that it ends in 1896 with the defeat of William Jennings Bryan. But I'm arguing that it does not end until the New Deal. There were important generational links between populism, the populism of the 1880s and 1890s, and the neo-populism in the 1930s. So there were people who had that knowledge, who perpetuated it, and who led farmers groups, who led veterans groups, and who organized, who kept those moral economies alive long enough for them to be activated in the context of the Great Depression. Like the first wave, it also ended in violence. In the first wave, one of the ways of thinking about the first wave of politicization is that, you know, when Shay's rebellion was crushed, that's the end of popular money politics, or at least one of it, and it was state violence against veterans.
Can you describe that?
Sure. So we're going back now to the 1780s, where many of the people who had fought in the Revolutionary War came back, faced very high debt, faced high taxes, and found that their economic conditions had not really changed all that much, or had even worsened compared to the colonial era. So many of them had participated in money politics before. They had seen that what's possible, and now they were threatened by debtor's prison. Many of them ended up in debtor's prison. And what they did is they asked for more paper money issued. They shut down courts, and they ended up arming themselves. Again, it's important to. It's typically said that those events are described as Shay's rebellion. They did not see themselves as rebels. They saw what we today think of as the government. They saw the government as the rebels. They were a legitimate authority, right? The government had huge problems financing itself. They put together an army by using privately raised funds, and there was an engagement. There was a battle, and I think two veterans were killed, or two members of Shay's army were killed. Something comparable happens in the 1930s when veterans, World War I veterans, walk on DC. And set up camp, and it's a very important event. It's called the Bonus March, demanding advance payment of a bonus that was due them for their service that the government owed them. Hoover said the government cannot afford it unless we threaten the viability of the gold standard, and they were skeptical of that, and they said, well, you know, we're more important than the gold standard. You have you're using the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to give money to all kinds of actors that we think of as shady. We also have the right to participate in this, and so hundreds and hundreds of people, some of them veterans, some of them with their families, camped in front of Congress, demanding an early payment of that by issuing greenbacks. So they were connected to neo-greenbackers. After some time, Hoover sent the armed forces, and again, I think two or three people were killed. Two or three of the bonus marchers were killed. So both waves of politicization ended violence, but in the 1930s, the difference was it was not quite over. In 1932, when Roosevelt took over, he didn't. I don't think he had a master plan in terms of how to deal with money politics, or how to deal with the farmers and the veterans, the two of the major groups that demanded that really again mobilized moral economies of money, And what he did is he step by step in the first several months of his presidency, he removed one by one all the issues that were connected to the moral economies, but he replaced them with the notion of rights. So he didn't, when the bonus marchers again went to Washington to demand an early payment, he did not send the military, but he offered them jobs. Right, so that's a very, very significant and of course much, much preferable way of dealing with popular demands. And at the same time, what happened is that he consistently denied all ways of thinking about money as political. He used all kinds of forms of thinking and talking about the monetary system and the banking system. He used moralistic tropes, blaming greedy bankers. He used he talked about banks as something that's always necessarily there in the form that was known. That's not really changing. It's an unchanging part of the political landscape. It's a neutral background. So it's not, he did whatever he could to depoliticize money. And at the same time, he did this crucial advance, which is to really, truly legitimize some people's rights, some people's socioeconomic rights. So we know, of course, that those socioeconomic rights were severely limited, and they applied primarily, once again, to white men. Right, but what happened is that he granted rights, and he, you know, with the economic bill of rights, with social security, all those access to housing finance, all of which were geared towards white men. So there was the sense that there was a right, that there was a set of rights that was new, and it was a right in important ways. It was a right to stabilized access to money. But at the same time, by granting those rights while denying a moral economy, granting those rights especially to a group that had previously, or that still had by far the loudest voice in national politics and in local politics and in state politics, so by granting those rights, he also discouraged moral economies, because for a time he made them less necessary for that group, right? So on the one hand, by actively discouraging neo-populists, and on the other hand, by granting rights to a select group of people, the New Deal ended up being one of the most, or maybe the most effective silencing mechanism for silencing moral economies of money. And I think we see that in the post-war period too, where you have money is constantly politicized. You know, you have the community reinvestment movement. You have movements like feminists demanding access to credit cards independent from their men. You have all kinds of politicization, and money is never really depoliticized. But there is never, again, the sense that money is inherently a public good. That was lost after, or that was very much marginalized at the very least after the New Deal.
If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold."
So I'd like to just take a moment to maybe pause, and this could be an opportunity for our producer, Alex Williams, to come in and insert a cartoon screeching sound effect. A lot of people listening might hear you say that the New Deal being marking the kind of end of money politics, or of the kind of revolutionary money politics, as counterintuitive. And I think that's, you know, want to sort of pause and reflect on a couple of really interesting and innovative and I think very useful moves you make. First, to call it money politics is provocative. I think today we sort of, you know, in public discourse tend to figure them as opposites, as opposed, money and politics. We want money out of politics. But then also, yeah, the kind of marking the New Deal as a departure or a time when money politics kind of becomes marginalized, it loses its voice over the next decades. So I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that, and I wonder what you make of that specifically. So what can we make of the fact that people today, I think a lot of folks, look back at the New Deal as kind of the mark of the beginning of something different, where money is politicized or put to more public ends, or I don't know quite how to put it, but how do we account for that counterintuitive move and how it doesn't seem to line up with a lot of what I think a lot of people think.
Absolutely. So I think that's really critical. I think there are two things. One is the way money is actually being organized institutionally, and the other one is how people can talk about money, right? So in the sense that policymakers claim much more maneuvering space, and much more maneuvering space is granted them in terms of money, right? There is a different way of thinking about money in policymaking circles, etc. That's one thing. The other one, and there's also this undeniable process where a privileged group gets very, very stable access to money that allows them to build wealth, with the housing finance that David Freund writes about. You have a process where publicly organized credit enables white suburbs to flourish, right? So as a matter of institutional fact, that is what's happening, right? There's a very large scale public investment, public credit mechanisms, public money creation, etc. So as an institutional fact, I think that that's clear. But at the same time you have a process where it's organized inside the discourse and the way people relate to money. It's still as though they were relating to something that is a creature of the market, right? So the New Deal didn't really, or actually FDR actively discouraged people from thinking about money as a public good, even as he or his administration did all those major restructurings of money. And that ends up being That has really important effects later on. When it has important effects, one, because it kind of it marks the boundaries for the anti-racist movements and the anti-sexist movements that try to make the New Deal order more just, because it sets the boundaries for them, because they can they don't have the same kind of power. They can put the same kind of pressure on public institutions and on politicians, etc., that as the veterans or as the farmers in the Great Depression. So they don't have that really robust understanding of money as a public good. So that's the first effect. And the second effect is, once the welfare state is being chipped away and once those stabilized modes of access to money are chipped away, you now have a situation where that is distinct from the situation that's before the Green New, before the original New Deal, because in some ways it's worse, because people no longer have the possibility to claim money as a public good, and they have been deprived of New Deal modes of access to it, right? So there's no longer that, there's a different potential for engaging monetary institutions, and there's no longer the New Deal access. So it's kind of the worst of both worlds.
Welcome to neoliberalism, right?
Yes, I think that's what it is, and that's why I'm trying to push that a little bit, that it at least in the sense of depoliticizing money, I'm not, I think, or if we look very specifically at money, and for a second bracket everything else, there is a continuity between, or at least a consistency or commonality between the New Deal and neoliberalism, in the sense that both depoliticize money while at the same time engaging in all kinds of major projects of restructuring.
And so it seems like the way you describe the New Deal and as the relation to the planning of neoliberalism, that fundamentally, and this is something that I think we consider a lot in this podcast, one of your main interventions is to say that the New Deal itself isn't necessarily what it was rhetorically claimed to be, that it wasn't an intervention into the market, that money and the politics of money is constitutive of all the planning that went on in the New Deal. And so when it's looked at in that way, it seems a bit more obvious, less counterintuitive as to how things seem to fall apart when it comes to monetary politics, because when we view money as a creature of the market, we can see the ways in which the government is outside of it and politics is outside of it, which is obviously, as MMT and neo-chartalism would say, not true. But I think more importantly, it colors the way people interact with money in a way that decreases their own agency. And I see that fundamentally as one of the main takeaways of your work.
Sorry. Okay. I think that really works. Yes. I think that's correct.
I just wanted to say too that going back and looking at FDR's rhetoric, you know, public speeches, and then also internal documents, it's interesting to discover quite a fan of balanced budgets for much of his tenure as president. So.
Oh yeah,
a bit of a half a gangster in terms of the money politics.
Absolutely, and he ran as a balanced. I mean, he was publicly, you know, that was part of his first campaign, at least, that he was a balanced budget guy.
So how do you deal with the fact that your protagonists in this important story are predominantly white men, often property-owning white men, who sort of imagine themselves as independent? I mean, obviously you have a complicated rhetorical problem on your hands of wanting to affirm parts of these histories, but also critique and complicate them as well. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And one of the ways I'm thinking about that is maybe that's a good thing to mention is I'm using Aziz Rana's book, The Two Faces of American Liberty, where he's trying to do on a larger scale for, you know, for many areas of political life what I'm trying to do just for money, which is that trying to look at you know, really robust democratic practices in the North American past, and at the same time look at how that those robust democratic practices for a very specific group were based on the exclusion of others. So try to take both seriously and try to see if it's possible, just possible to think if those freedoms and those liberties and those really robust ways of thinking about democracy, if they can be extended and if they can be generalized. He says universalized. So that's a key question that's at stake here, I think. And given that it's a way of trying to inherit the institutions that we have inherited, while avoiding all those the exclusions and while trying to go beyond those exclusions and not and because a pure rejection or a pure rejection is not something that necessarily enables that enables agency in the present, right? So I think there needs to be a way of historically understanding the institutions that we have inherited in order to be able to make them differently and to practice them differently.
And pulling a few threads together here, I think some of the implications of this discussion are that in the imagination about and struggle for a Green New Deal, money can't be external to that project, and to make it external to that project is misguided, and we do so only at our own peril. And then, equally so, we can say that, as many have pointed out, the original New Deal was tremendously biased toward white men, and so I wonder if how much you've thought about the new context of the Green New Deal and how important that is for you.
Yes. Yeah, so what I think is that maybe on a discursive level, that the proponents of the Green New Deal are at least, and especially the job guarantee, are still inheriting the New Deal dichotomy between, on the one hand, there's technical issues that ordinary people don't need to worry about, and on the other hand, there are those really robust rights and human rights, especially the right to a job, right? So I wonder if, because before the New Deal, some non-elite groups could connect those two, right? They articulated money as a public good and their rights as a context in that institutional context. That's what's really distinctive about moral economies, that you can connect institutions to your rights and not see the rights as something that you just claim without institutional grounding, really. The way I hear it is, I hear on the one hand the technical argument about the job guarantee as a macroeconomic stabilizer, etc. And on the other hand, I hear that the right to a job as a human right, both of which I agree, of course. At the same time, to develop a progressive and inclusive moral economy of money that works for today, I think it could be important to stress money as an arrangement that connects people, that enables societies to coordinate what they do, and the job guarantee as more than a right to a job, but a possibility inherent in this large-scale institution that people are already part of, which is the large-scale institutions of money, right? So I see a potential for developing moral economies of money. I'm not in a position to say if that should be a priority when talking about the Green New Deal. There are so many other issues at stake, and it's so urgent, and it's so important. But I don't know if it's currently, you know, there's some ways to go to develop a truly moral economy of money that at the level of, you know, what the populists did.
Throughout your study, you seem to be pretty keenly focused on the question of media and mediation, be it the material substrate used as money or various forms of aesthetic practices about money, perhaps including the ways in which media is used to influence money politics. Would you mind ruminating about the importance of media and these questions in your work for our listeners?
Absolutely. So I think about it in two ways. I think about it not just in terms of what people know, but how this apparatus money, you know, how it talks to them, what it tells them. What does a bank, an ATM tell me when I withdraw money? Or what does a bank note today tell me? Or how am I connected to this set of relations that reaches me or does not reach me? And that's very importantly, you know, that's also a material process. There's the way a bill of credit talks to you is very different from an ATM or a credit card, and especially in as part of a larger discursive frame and as part of a larger knowledge about what money is, and those knowledges are really everywhere. They're not just in, you know, political debates. They're in novels. They're in all kinds of forms of cultural production that I'm trying to unearth and document systematically in order to find out how people thought of themselves in relation to money, in terms of subject formation, what kinds of people do we think we can be in relation to this institution, right? And so that's where media is not just a little add-on about representation or a little, you know, it's a little error. It's actually constitutive of what money is today, is the way people talk about it and the way the languages we have or we do not have or we no longer have to talk about this.
So riffing on that, you know, I think in my own conversations with people about money and it's kind of what it says to them and how they understand themselves in relation to it. And I mean, certainly it's not just my discipline, but my discipline and other disciplines in the humanities kind of looking at money as a kind of just a generically social constructionist project that, you know, kind of buying into the Friedman tale that, you know, money is money because we believe it is money. And so, I mean, you're saying that it's more than that, and I agree, and that we need to kind of interrogate our relations with money and money's relations with us. You know, I know that your project kind of is firmly situated in the present, right? This history is being done in order to better understand where we are. So kind of given the lay of the land, and I think given the way that I don't think it's just the people I've spoken to, given the way that a lot of people imagine, you know, the money relation today, what's next for us? Like, what's our next steps? What's the future of money on the left?
So I wish I had a good answer to that.
We'll take anything.
So I think there's no clear, I don't have any clear pathways to offer, but I think there are a couple of things that I want to mention. And one of them is that given that money was politicized for such long periods, the current rise of, you know, politicization is much less surprising than it might appear at first sight. So there is, you know, there is really a lot of history. This is not something that emerges from out of nothing. And it's clear that in the decades since Occupy, MMT has punctured monetary silence. And at the same time, I think what I said about the moral economy, for instance, the moral economy of a job guarantee, that so many people are, you know, really electrified by this idea of being able to understand money, and so many and how liberating it is to have all those mystifications, truncated moral economies, moralistic understanding of money, which are really all ways of erecting barriers between most money users and the institutions they depend on. So you have this really electrifying potential and this liberating potential of people, you know, and this democratic potential, which I think is absolutely great. And the other one, that is kind of an unbelievable development, especially in the last few months. And at the same time, I think there is also a lot of leeway still for developing truly. And I think, Scott, you have done in your book, you have done a lot of work that goes in that direction of developing a moral economy, a way of relating to money that can become a common sense, that can become a typical way of understanding money that's not reductionist, that doesn't mean that everyone knows all the technical details, but basically that vaccinates people against ahistorical and a-institutional lies about money, and that enables people to develop a moral economy, which really means a sense of what a just society could look like if we rearrange money and use money in accordance with that vision of social justice. So I see a lot of potential for using that electrifying potential, that electrifying process of understanding money through a Chartist lens, and creating a really deep sense of what society is, what a society can do, and what a society can be through that.
Yeah, thank you. I think this also puts into relief one of the problematic, I think problematic tropes that sometimes surrounds MMT and MMT culture, which is this kind of framing that, well, MMT is, you know, really just merely describing. It's giving us a technical understanding, when in fact, at the very same time, the very people who are vociferously, sometimes angrily, claiming this on social media are enacting and disavowing their own participation in moral economic processes.
Yes, so I think that idea that there is something like a technical description of reality, I think that's misguided, you know, because if you talk about let's say the relation between capital and labor as a conflictive relation, and then you say, well, that is the description, that's a neutral description of reality, and, you know, and what you do with that, that's a different story. I don't think so. I think there's politics in that description, because that description allows you, and it encourages you, and it allows you to think about politics in a specific way. So I don't think there's any neutral description of monetary institutions. Yeah.
Jakob, thank you so much for coming on Money on the Left.
Thank you.